Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The success of Christopher Nolan's blockbuster film Dunkirk has sparked new interest in this unique event during the Second World War, a case of disaster averted, and how a catastrophic military defeat was perceived as a moral victory. Over 338,000 men of the British and French armies were taken off Dunkirk's beaches between May 27th and June 4th, 1940. The men would later play a role in the liberation of Western Europe, but more importantly, the success of the evacuation gave Britain the will to resist alone, as they would for the next 18 months. Author Michael Korda is my guest today. He's a prolific author, historian, and the former longtime editor of Simon & Schuster. His new book is titled Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory. And it's a fascinating account of the days leading up to the war, a detailed account of the Battle of France, the story of the evacuation, and his own family story. Korda was 7 during the events of Dunkirk and was from a family with close ties to Winston Churchill. Korda's uncle was noted film director and producer Alexander Korda, his aunt, actress Merle Oberon, his mother, a British stage actress, and his father, the Oscar-winning set designer Vincent Korda. The family spent much of 1940 making films to bolster Britain's morale. The book recounts the cataclysmic events of the early days of the war, but also shares one family's reaction to them. It's a wonderful read. Alone is the name of the new book, and Michael Korda is my guest. Michael Korda, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your latest book, Alone, is this wonderful, interesting mix of geopolitics, military history, and then also personal and family memoir about the early days of World War II and the events leading up to the Second World War. What interested you in going back to your childhood memories and inserting this into what could have been just a straightforward history of the early days of World War II?
Well, I'm not sure if the world needs another history of the beginning of World War II. But what I did want to write about was how we stumbled into the war, unprepared and in the wrong time, and what those events felt like. I mean, admittedly, I was only 6 years old when the war broke out in 1939, but I was still there, heard things, listened to Neville Chamberlain tell us we were at war. My family was involved with so many different things and also closely involved with Winston Churchill. And so I thought that telling it from my point of view, but then going back and weaving in the history, would give it a pace and a personality that it might not otherwise have. It's not just a straight history, it's a story, and that story begins on September 3rd with the declaration of war and ends with the successful evacuation of Dunkirk.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, your family, your father was a set designer, an Academy Award-winning set designer, Vincent Korda, and your uncle was an amazing director and producer, Alexander Korda. And I guess Alex was sort of the head of the family. He was the oldest brother.
Yes.
And you write that basically he made the decisions for the entire family, the extended family, and that both your father and your brother were very much a part of the men in the wilderness in the 1930s. They were about confronting Hitler. They had left Hungary because of the fascists taking over Hungary, which most people are not even aware of in this country. In the 1930s, and they believed in confronting Hitler. And so they were part of Churchill's group and actually were sort of a supporter of Churchill, weren't
they? Very strongly, very strongly. And I remember him well. Of course, I was a child. I mean, I didn't say I knew him well because a 6 or 7 year old child, but I met him frequently and I went to school with his grandson. So, and he was very close to my Uncle Alex and to my father. So he was a vivid personality, and I remember that very, very, very strongly. It was an extraordinary period because, as I point out in the book, the assumption was that London and the other cities in the south of England would be destroyed on the first day of the war and the poison gas would be used. And so before the war even broke out, a year before it broke out, everybody was supplied with a gas mask. And everybody had to carry one at all times. And there were even special gas masks shaped rather like a shopping bag with a plastic top for babies. The notion that war was about to come did not come to us as a great surprise. Unlike, for example, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, we had had several years in which there was a presumption that war was coming and that it could happen at any minute.
But at the same time, I think one of the interesting things you do is you take great pains to let us know that as a 6 or 7 year old, you had no idea how momentous the events you were living in were because you had no experience.
No.
And but yet, at the same time, I imagine it was really interesting going back to sort of search your childhood memories, now knowing what momentous history you were living through.
Well, exactly. I go back and I look at it now, and I've gone back and found all the diaries and letters that people wrote during that first year of the war, and above all, in the retreat to Dunkirk and then on the beach at Dunkirk. So I've been able to, as it were, flesh out what was happening and tell it from a different point of view. I think it's at once personal and objective. And I've tried to be objective about everybody involved. I mean, it's hard to be objective about Hitler, and I don't suppose that I would succeed even if I did try. But I have been objective about his decisions. There's a very strong tendency in writing the history of the early years of the war, for that and the later years of the war, to blame Hitler for every military decision that failed. But the truth of the matter is that since he killed himself in April 1945 and most of his generals survived, all of them lived to write memoirs in which they very naturally said Hitler was responsible for anything that went wrong. So you have to look at that kind of thing very skeptically and go back to the original source material. And of course, he was wrong about a great many things, and not only wrong, but criminal. But he wasn't always wrong. And in that sense, I've tried to take a really hard new look. The French, for example, come in for huge criticisms.
Yes.
But the French army consisted of 3,500,000 men. The British army in France consisted of only 350,000. So the ability of France to sustain the German attack when it came would never be entirely dependent on the British army, though that was our regular and professional army, because it was by comparison tiny. Nor did we have, as the French did, the experience of surrendering and having 2,500,000 prisoners of war taken to Eastern Germany and Poland for 5 years to work in the potato and turnip fields with no gloves and no winter clothes and hardly any food or medical help. There's been a tendency to ignore what really happened in the Second World War and tell it from a single point of view. And I've tried very hard not to do that.
Well, let's talk about where your book ends, and that's in Dunkirk. And there's a couple of things there. One, you alluded to all the French soldiers that ended up in prisoner of war camps.
Yeah.
When we think of the Dunkirk evacuation, we think of the evacuation of the British forces. But in fact, Churchill and the British command took a lot of pains to take off as many French soldiers as they could. In fact,
they took as many as they could, absolutely.
And what's interesting is most of them immediately said, we want to go back to France. They surrendered and ended up going to German POW camps for the duration.
Yes.
That is amazing. We think of the French that left at Dunkirk as being part of the Free French Forces, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
No, the Free French Forces were always tiny, although I'm a great sympathizer and advocate of the Free French Forces. But then the British avoided, thanks to Churchill and thanks to Dunkirk, they avoided the awful necessity of surrendering to the Germans. There is no country in Europe that the Germans occupied between 1939 and 1945 that didn't suffer to a very sizable degree. And we avoided that. And Churchill, I think one of the most dramatic moments in Alone is when Churchill, sensing that there is an underlying intention in the war cabinet to seek out what terms of surrender Hitler might offer to Great Britain, which he knows he doesn't want to do and will not accept. He breaks off the meeting and goes down to a meeting of the larger war cabinet, which is 20 or 30 people in a crowded small room in the house behind the House of Commons, and has to stand on a desk in order to be heard and seen. And he says, we will never surrender. We will fight on, if necessary, for years, if necessary, alone, from which I take the title of my book. And then goes on to say, if our Long Island story is to end, let it end when each of us lies choking on the floor on his own blood. And the entire cabinet cheers and claps him on the back and applauds. And so he goes up to number 10, goes back to number 10 Downing Street, buoyed by this reception, to hear that 27,000 men have been taken off the beach in one day at Dunkirk. And from that moment on, knows that he can eliminate all chance of our seeking out peace terms. He says, we will never surrender, but even to discuss it and to think about it is to stand on the slippery slope. And that's the moment at which, in effect, we were committed to continue the war and not to surrender. Had we surrendered, as many people wanted us to do and thought we would do in May of 1940, the world would be an even nastier and more brutal place than it is now.
Now, earlier you were talking about the fact that we hear the German side of the story strictly from the generals that survived the war. And, of course, one of the great blunders thought to be perpetrated by the Germans during the Battle of France was stopping the tanks from going into Dunkirk.
Yes.
And that's always been blamed on Hitler and Goering. They wanted the Luftwaffe to basically destroy the troops on the beaches. But you're actually somewhat sympathetic. And it was less a blunder than just a failure of nerve at their overwhelming success.
Well, yes, I think several things happened. It conspired to save Britain and the rest of the world as a result. In the first place, Hitler was indeed, in May of 1940, like a gambler who has put down all his money on one number at the roulette wheel and won, and is now fiercely debating whether he should put all that money on another number or walk away from the table with the money in his pocket. And he was reluctant to take any risk, but at the same time he knew that he probably would have to take some risk. It's a difficult position to be in. The generals, the German generals, still tended to think, the older and more powerful ones, that tanks were basically armored mechanical horses. And they knew that with horses, after a certain amount of time, you need to stop, rest them, clean them, shoe them, do whatever you need to do with horses. And they assumed that the same was true of the tanks. And the tanks, if they were not given a rest and service, would be useless to them when they turned to the southwest to attack the remaining bulk of the French army. So Hitler allowed himself to be persuaded that the tanks should take a 48-hour rest. This is the point when some of the tank commanders, divisional commanders, could actually see the beach at Dunkirk from their tank. So the tank commanders were furious, but once that decision was made, they had to wait 48 hours. And that 48 hours was sufficient to create a line around Dunkirk that the British and the French could hold while the bulk of the troops were taken off the beach. It is one of the critical decisions of the war. It's never been examined in the kind of detail that I examine it and with the original documents in view, but it is a critical moment. It is the moment at which Hitler came within reach of winning the war in May of 1940. And at the moment of his greatest triumph, he failed.
That's really interesting. Now, at the same time, as I mentioned, Alone is this book of geopolitics and military history, but it's also this personal story. And at the same time this is happening, you know, your own family is dealing with all sorts of other issues because they're busy in the film business. And you tell the story of the Korda family's involvement with that Hamilton woman, which was known as Winston Churchill's favorite movie. And we find out very quickly in the book why it was his favorite movie, because he was actually helping fund it through the British government. It was a propaganda piece that was eventually completed in Hollywood. And in fact, if it wasn't for the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, your uncle might have been appearing before Congress and
and having to way to Washington on December 7th to testify before a congressional committee.
Why he was making propaganda.
Pro-British propaganda movies in the United States. But the Japanese saved him from that need. Because my family were committed to making large films, which Churchill very much wanted them to do. He wanted to prove the British film industry was alive and kicking. But also he wanted and believed strongly that in order to be effective, films should not be open propaganda films. They should somehow convey the strength and resolve of Britain, and also the generosity and spirit of the British people and British history. So unlike the German propaganda films, which are literally painfully unwatchable because they're so cruel and so full of noisy music and marching, that Hamilton woman, the story of Admiral Nelson and Lady Hamilton, his mistress for some years, is actually a love story beneath which there is a very strong dose of propaganda. And they also made The Thief of Baghdad, for which my father won an Oscar in 1940, and Jungle Book, which to my mind was one of the most wonderful of movies, still is a wonderful movie, better than all the Jungle Books that have followed it. So they had a mission, and that mission was to make movies that portrayed an England that was still vibrant and alive and able to produce major motion pictures, and they did.
My guest today is Michael Korda, author, editor, and in recent years, historian. His latest book is titled Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory. It's published by Live Right, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, while this was affecting the family, your biggest, effect of the Second World War was Operation Pied Piper, which you go into a bit of depth about. This is the relocation of children within the cities, and especially in the low-income areas, from the city to the country. Now, you first escaped it by going to your nanny's farm in Yorkshire, which was probably about the same experience, but perhaps with maybe a little more tenderness than some of the city kids received. But eventually, you did end up at the Isle of Wight, which is the one place the Germans did occupy in the UK during the war, which is sort of really interesting in and of itself. But what's interesting, your take was that, you know, this was a crazy government policy in which the families that had children that were leaving didn't want their children to go to places where they didn't want the children there to begin with.
No, it was, you know, all big social policies are usually misguided. But it's a measure of how coldly realistic the British were about the consequences of history between 1936 and 1939, that they made plans under the faintly risible codename Operation Pied Piper to evacuate more than 2 million children from London and the other cities in the south to the north of England, and eventually a smaller but still significant number of children from England to Canada and from there to the United States, myself being one of them, and that they did, for example, make and stock hundreds of thousands of collapsible cardboard coffins in the expectation that there would be huge casualties in the first days of the war, and to print over 1 million pre-printed death certificates and send them to local authorities so that they would have a stack of them ready for the occasion. In short, although the British are constantly portrayed as trying to avoid the war, which they certainly were, because who wouldn't, they were at the same time resigned to what the consequences of British foreign policy would be if the Germans continued to resist it, and prepared for it in surprising ways.
Now, it's also interesting that even after the Battle of France gets underway, there's a slow understanding that the war was lost pretty quickly, that battle was lost pretty quickly, that there was no stopping the Germans going into northwest France. And really, another hero of the book is the admiral that controlled Dover Station, the Dover part of the English coast.
Admiral Ramsay, yes. Yes,
Admiral Ramsay, who basically, once the battle was begun, he said, okay, we need contingency plans on what happens if it goes poorly. And
it's an amazing piece of forethought. Ramsay managed to run an ad in the Times asking everybody in England who owned a boat of any size to register it immediately, and they did. 800 or 900 boats were registered, and the smallest of them, 14 foot 4 inches long with an outboard motor, crewed and mostly owned entirely by civilians, fishing boats, motor boats, even the fire boats from the Thames and the Thames excursion steamers, all were taken south to pick the men up off the beaches from Dunkirk. It's an extraordinary story. It is at once a miracle and a deliverance. And I don't know that there's any other equivalent in history that I can think of that number of men being taken off a beach under shell fire, bombing, machine gun fire, every mines, you name it, every possible weapon that the Germans could aim at them, but nevertheless succeeding in taking that number of men off.
Now, a lot of contemporary filmgoers are becoming re-familiar with this story of Dunkirk through the Christopher Nolan film, which came out this summer. And as I read your book, it's like, as you well know from your own film background, from your family, that films usually take a lot of liberties with the story. And what's really amazing is that so many of the events, while they may be slightly fictionalized, are amazingly true to life.
Absolutely. When I saw the Christopher Nolan film, I was astonished at how much of it was accurate. I mean, several people in the media asked me if I would go and see the film, which I wanted to see anyway, and point out what, you know, the things in it that were inconsistent and things in it that were wrong. And I went and I saw the film, and I came back and said, you know, first of all, I didn't want to do this because I liked the film. I really thought it was wonderful. One of the best war movies I've ever seen, if not the best. But secondly, it's nitpicking. You know, if I tell you that X was wearing the wrong buttons on his uniform, I said all I could do would be nitpicking. And I don't want to nitpick Christopher Nolan because I think his movie is wonderful, and I think he has a good chance of winning an Academy Award for it. I was very moved by it, and to my astonishment, I saw it in Red Hook, New York, which is perhaps 15 miles from Poughkeepsie. And I saw it there in the middle of the afternoon, and to my astonishment, the theater was jam-packed full. I was lucky to get a seat. And at the end of the film, the entire audience stood and applauded, and many of them with tears in their eyes. And I thought, that's really strange. I mean, this is an event in English history that took place 77 years ago when the Americans were in the war. And yet the audience was swept up by the emotion of it. And I hope that they will be in alone, because this is the road to Dunkirk. It's how we got there. It's what people felt like when they did get there, and it's how they were taken off the beach.
And that little key that went out into the ocean, which we see Kenneth Branagh as the officer,
yes.
That was absolutely true.
Absolutely.
You tell the story of a boat that very much mirrors a story that's in the film of this gentleman was a second officer on the Titanic and survived. Took his small boat across, and basically when he was asked to step aside and let British Navy personnel take over, he said, forget that, I'm going over myself, and did the same sort of thing.
Charles Lightoller, second officer of the Titanic. It was his boat, and he took with him his teenage son and his teenage son's closest friend. And so if there's a real-life equivalent there to the story in the film. And Lightoller was an amazing man. Between he and his son and a teenage friend, they took upwards of 400 people off the beach in a boat that's maybe 25, 26 feet long.
Wow.
I mean, they did. Obviously, that's multiple trips. You know, they didn't take 400 in one go. But people really did that. They came out, civilians, and they took tremendous risks. Because, for one thing, although it's 35 miles from Dover to Calais, the Germans were already in Calais, and you can't go directly from Dover to Dunkirk because there were British minefields in the way and also shoals. So you had to go round towards the east into the North Sea to get to Dunkirk, thus exposing yourself to German aircraft and German submarines and the German equivalent of PT boats on the way. And it was a 75-mile journey. Well, you know, in a 25-foot motorboat or 14-foot
dinghy,
14-foot, 4-inch-long boat with an outboard motor. That's a long trip at sea.
Yes, it is. Well, I want to close with another question, and one of the things the book alone does point out is this mistrust between Britain and France that was so deep-seated that it's no surprise that the defense of France in 1940 was doomed because there was just so much mistrust and between the two countries, and for every Francophile. There was a Francophobe, an Anglophile, an Anglophobe on the French side. As I was reading through the book, I said, you know, this gives me new insight into this whole contemporary UK decision of Brexit.
Yes, I think what I didn't do that deliberately. I couldn't have imagined that Brexit would happen. But yes, it does, because unquestionably, the distrust, the mistrust between France and England, or perhaps to put more accurately, between France and Europe,
or England
was
and Europe,
very strong. And in the case of the French, goes back for 900 years. I mean, as I point out in Alone, the first thing that any child in France learns when they start to learn history is the burning of Joan of Arc, arranged by the British in the 1400s. So there's an enmity between England and France that goes back for hundreds of years and was very difficult to overcome.
Well, it certainly was. And as I mentioned, as I was reading through, it's like, oh, this sort of explains this idea. And at the very end of the book, you say, you know, maybe this does explain the whole reason for Brexit. There's just this mistrust.
I think it does, in the sense that the British feel most comfortable when they're behind the White Cliffs of Dover and are protected by that 21 miles of generally very rough and unpleasant sea between ourselves and the French and the Belgian coast. And that's expressed very well at the end of Alone, when the king, realizing that the French are about to surrender, writes to his mother, Queen Mary, personally, I feel so relieved now that we have no more allies to pamper. That's a very English feeling, the notion that you have lost your only ally, and that you have had to leave the continent of Europe in small boats, the men without their rifles or their boots or helmets, and that you're now alone, hence the title of the book, fighting against the Germans. There's a very English instinct to feel that that's good, that that's a benefit, that that's the way it ought to be. And I think that that is one of the things that Alone expresses, is that basic English feeling that if you just get back and hunker down behind the White Cliffs of Dover, that things will be better.
Well, I have to tell you, it was a wonderful read. I really enjoyed it. Michael Korda, thank you very much for your
time. Thank you very much for having me.
Author and historian Michael Korda speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory. It's published by Live Right. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.